TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Climate change is here. Now what? Professor Bill Collins. The Berkeley Lab, short for Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, overlooks the campus of the University of California, Berkeley. After its founding in 1931, it grew so fast in lab and space needs for the cyclotron and other equipment that it had to move uphill. Berkeley Lab conducts scientific research on behalf of the U.S. Department of Energy. It is managed and operated by the University of California. This is what they say about themselves on the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab website. The lab's 20 scientific divisions are organized within 6 areas of research: computing, physical sciences, energy and environmental sciences, biosciences, and energy technologies. The Berkeley Lab and Bill Collins came to my attention when I heard that they were planning to strengthen their focus on climate change. In September 2015, the Berkeley Lab established the Climate and Ecosystem Sciences Division. The mission of the new division is to understand, predict, and advance stewardship of the Earth's climate and ecosystems. They pay attention to water, energy, and agriculture. The director of the new Climate and Ecosystem Science Division is Dr. Bill Collins. He's an internationally recognized expert in climate modeling and climate change science, and also serves as director of the Climate Readiness Institute, a new multi-campus initiative to prepare the San Francisco Bay Area for climate change. The Berkeley Lab conducts public events to introduce their staff and research issues and answer questions from the audience. On March 24, 2016, they held the event Climate Change is Here, Now What? Jeff Miller is head of public affairs at Berkeley Lab. He brought Professor Collins on stage for an extensive interview about climate change, how we know it, and what we can do about it. Here are some of the highlights of their conversation.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Science at the Theater, sponsored by the Friends of Berkeley Lab. My name is Jeff Miller. I'm head of public affairs at the lab, and I will be your host for this evening. Tonight's show is entitled Climate Change is Here, Now What? When we say now what, we really mean that. The last time we did a climate change show a few years ago at Berkeley Rep, the news was not good. Everyone left in despair. And we don't want that to happen tonight. Tonight is going to not be about despair. Tonight's going to be about resilience and solutions and adaptation and imagination. Our guest this evening is Berkeley Lab's Bill Collins. Bill is Director of Climate and Ecosystem Sciences at the lab. He's a member of the Nobel Peace Prize-winning panel on climate change. And he also is Director of the Climate Readiness Institute, an organization you will be hearing more about this evening. So with that, welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I want you to go way into space and look back at the planet from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. Incorporate into your answer the fact that we have more carbon being pumped into the atmosphere than we've had in the last 56 years. Mm-hmm. That we may be facing a scenario, at least in popular literature and scary stuff, that we're looking at a world that's going to look like Waterworld from the movie where we're all driving around in boats and looking for food. Or are we looking at a scenario that we're Mars? Like Mars, we have a desiccated planet. And before you answer, one more thing. I want you to think about you're testifying in front of a congressional committee, and they're asking you, Dr. Collins, please give us the state of the planet right now. What would your answer be?
The state of the planet is good.
Okay.
But we are changing it pretty dramatically. And you asked about the view from space. We can see the change from space now. It's quite evident. It would be evident even if you were looking at the Earth from another solar system, quite literally, that the Earth is different than it has been in the past.
How so? What would you see?
Well, one of the things you can that Earth does now because of mankind is it emits all kinds of radio waves and other energy that the sun doesn't emit. So you could tell if you were in a solar system several light years away that the Earth was inhabited because it's emitting far more radar waves than a sun like our own sun could possibly emit. So you'd know immediately the Earth is inhabited. But you could also tell, if you had measurements that went back a little ways, that we've changed the composition of the Earth's atmosphere very dramatically. So if I were testifying to Congress, I would say we have really great information that we have altered the Earth, we mankind. We have entered into an era where man is a bigger actor, or at least as big an actor, on the planetary stage as nature herself.
James Hansen, who's known for his climate work, published a report that said that the climate change is actually worsening at a much more rapid pace. There's going to be catastrophic changes, even these giant ocean waves that are going to be heaving boulders onto the landscape. So what are your feelings about that? Is this sort of an extreme interpretation, or is that something that's real?
I knew you were going to ask me this question about the Hansen's paper. I think to his credit, you know, he went the right route. He published this in the scientific literature. It's going to take a while for the community as a whole to sort out the claims in that paper. And I think it's very, when we do an assessment of climate change, it's not based on one particular sort of X-Files type paper where there, you know, the truth is out there and we were just waiting to have the truth revealed to us. We're really going to have to examine the findings in that paper over time to understand them. Jim partly did this, I think, in order to reveal to people and to shock people into understanding how bad climate change could be. The information that politicians have needed to understand the severity of the problem has been out there for decades. And the fact that, even setting aside the Hansen paper, that people aren't awake at night worrying about this problem is kind of stunning. And I think we'll come back to this point at the end of our discussion this evening. But
okay.
There's plenty of information out there right now that says you should be extremely concerned about maintaining present course. And Jim's paper is just sort of one more log on the funeral pyre for maintaining the present course of action.
Well, let's talk about that disconnection for a second. Let's talk about real estate.
Okay.
So in preparation for this, I decided, you know, let me just take a look at Miami Beach. Mm-hmm. Let's look at real estate there, and let's just see what is being offered and at what price. Mm-hmm. So what does this tell us about the disconnect, and what is this real estate actually going to be worth by mid-century, do you suppose?
Florida is already experiencing flooding in a number of its communities now because of sea level rise. And this is partly because of the geology of Miami and the areas around it. Florida and the whole eastern seaboard are facing a real game changer if we experience 2 meters of sea level rise. That's going to permanently alter the geography of Florida. Florida and many other coastal communities on the eastern seaboard, including, I'm sorry to say, North Carolina, are exhibiting a deep form of, you know, see no evil, hear no evil, say no evil. And that's not a workable strategy.
So is the sea level rise that we hear, I mean, is it going to be 6 feet? How do we know? And how can we predict at this point?
Okay, well, one thing, we can set a floor underneath it. And the floor is already a pretty severe floor, but the floor is based on the fact that water expands when you heat it. And we have a pretty good idea of how hot the ocean is going to get this century if we continue business as usual. That equals about a foot of sea level rise. If you then take what we know is happening to land glaciers into the ice sheets, that triples the sea level rise. It brings it up to just about 3 feet or about a meter. Then if you start to trigger instabilities in the ice sheets, which we think is a real possibility, and we could come back to Greenland in just a moment, then a meter is sort of the, again, becomes a new foundation, and you start building from there. Just to amplify, I'm going to remind you, Jeff, that our point this evening is to convey a message of hope.
We're getting there. We're going to get
there.
Please don't worry.
I do want to. I'm going to bring you back to that point. But Greenland just this year opened up a new pathway for releasing ice into the ocean. There are four pathways out of Greenland into the ocean. One of them, which was featured in that movie Chasing Ice, mm-hmm. Was the one that was really prominently featured. But a new one just opened up in the northeast corner. So we're going to see a major contribution from Antarctica and Greenland to sea level rise this century. And they're already contributing. They're already contributing. A quarter of the sea level rise we're measuring right now is due to Greenland and Antarctica.
Okay, well, to shift gears just for a second, because I'm trying to use this opportunity this evening to cover a lot of ground. There is confusion still about the immediate impacts and then the difference between weather and climate. So could you just explain that for everyone at this point?
Difference between weather and climate?
Yes.
Let me take a step back here and answer perhaps a different question than you wanted me to answer. The human species has relied on having very stable and predictable zones where we know what we can grow, we know what will work in terms of agriculture, we know what will work in terms of cities, and we've enjoyed that since the dawn of agriculture 10,000 years ago. We've had a very, very stable climate. And what that's meant is that California has experienced a Mediterranean climate. So some years, like this year, we have a lot of rain. Mm-hmm. Other years, we don't. So the variability from year to year is the weather. That very predictable pattern where you know that you can we can grow grapes here and the grapes will do very well, that's the climate. If you go to Europe, they've known that they could grow grapes really well in southern France since the time of the Romans. That's something we've relied on as the foundation for our civilization. What we're doing right now is we're pulling the rug out from under that foundation and re-inject a little bit of hope into the conversation. So if we were to instantly could freeze the amount of CO2 and other greenhouse gases in the Earth's atmosphere and just hold them steady, what we would see over this century is about half a degree Celsius or close to about 1 degree Fahrenheit of temperature rise. That is pretty mild compared to what will happen if we maintain a business as usual scenario. So that you should consider that 1 degree Fahrenheit is being baked in from what we've already done to the climate system. That's not a huge amount of climate change. It's survivable. Mm-hmm. But the problem, just coming back to this issue around that serving as a foundation, what we're doing is we're accelerating the pace of change. Mm-hmm.
So given all that, I know you did not attend the Paris meeting in mm-hmm. December. Why are all the people in Paris mm-hmm. so happy? Why were they smiling?
There was a breakthrough there in terms of the structure of the agreement. And I think the agreement has been, one way you can tell it was successful is that it was criticized from almost all sides. That's often a measure of success around a compromise. The agreement is not... it isn't everything it should be, but what it did do is set up a new foundation for agreements going forward. Essentially said to everyone, bring in your best shot as to what you can do, and we'll tally this up and see what this amounts to. And so in contrast to previous attempts at negotiations, which had gotten completely wrapped around the axle of inequities in historical emissions mm-hmm. versus future commitments, in this one, 170 countries came, and only 10 countries that came did not come forward with agreements to participate. About a third of the countries said, we don't have a technological fix, but we'll agree not to log our forests. Mm-hmm. We'll keep that carbon sink in place. So that was a big step forward, because you got many, many, many members of the UN General Assembly agreeing to be part of the solution. Was it enough? No. Yeah. But you've opened the door now so that people realize that they can come to these agreements and perhaps put a bigger, take a bigger lift. And that, creating a structure which creates a path forward for successfully more stringent measures was the other big success coming out of Paris.
And wasn't there a monitoring component of, every 5 years, there's going to be monitoring progress?
There is a monitoring component, and it's set up as a ratchet mechanism so you can't slide backward. That's another very important piece of the agreement. The countries are only allowed to go forward, they're not allowed to backslip.
I have read figures as high as $44 trillion to switch out of a fossil fuel world into a renewable world. And I ask that question because when you see pictures coming out of Beijing of folks running in this horrific air, And you think about what might it take to fix that problem, and it seems so inexplicably tied into their economy that to fix it, are we not risking the undermining of the Chinese economy itself, which has other consequences, and there are other ramifications for the U.S. And as well in terms of our fear that it's going to, some people say that it will ruin our economy to go to a completely renewable society. So is it really possible to reduce greenhouse gas emissions without wrecking the economy at the same time?
Yes, there's a part of the IPCC assessment, not the part that I dealt with, but the one that deals with measures to mitigate climate change that has looked very hard at this. And you quoted, the number you quoted was sort of a number that's integrated over probably decades to a century worth of investment in clean energy. If you look at the dollar expenditure on an annual basis, it's something on the range of 3 to 5% GDP. It is not, you know, an economy killer by any stretch of the imagination. And I think, rather than talk about hypotheticals, let's talk about some really shining successes in this story.
Yeah.
Germany made a commitment a while ago to switch to renewables. They are now 30% renewable. Germany is not doing badly as an economy. Let's take California as an example. Thanks to the energy crisis in the 1970s, California committed itself to halving the carbon intensity of its economy. So we now expend half as much carbon for every dollar produced as the rest of the country combined. And I would also argue that California is doing pretty darn well. So those are two great examples, one local, one international, where switching to clean energy has improved environmental quality, and the people who have done it have really made out like gangsters. But I was going to actually accuse you of channeling the Chicago School of Economics here just a moment ago, because the only thing you mentioned was the economic downside to switching. There's a huge economic downside to not switching, and I think that those costs are ones that also have to be factored into these considerations, and those are very real.
So give me some examples.
Well, you were just quoting me a moment ago, the real estate prices of just one street in Miami, right, that might go underwater. So imagine taking large portions of Florida and rendering them almost uninhabitable, and ask yourself what the dollar value is of that, and then multiply that by coastlines around the world. I mean, we're looking at displacing, even with a meter of sea level rise, over 100 million people, probably close to 200 million off the coastlines. That costs money too. You look at other countries that are taking this very seriously, like the Netherlands, and the Netherlands is now busy exploring how to put housing on pontoons. And I am happy to say, by the way, that San Francisco is partnering with cities in the Netherlands to figure out how to adapt here, because it's going to be a very serious issue.
From a California perspective, and then the larger issue of water and the climate change, we often don't zero in on that. We talk about sea level rise, but we don't talk about the distribution of water and the system.
Right.
So could we talk about that for a little bit?
Sure.
What challenges California faces?
One of the silver linings of climate change is that it's putting water vapor into the Earth's atmosphere. Sort of the dark cloud that silver lining is surrounding is the fact that where the water is falling is moving. So the storm tracks that have fed water into California for its entire recorded history, in fact, its entire geologic history, those storm tracks are moving northward. We can measure that from space. We can measure it from the ground. And at the same time, as we make the climate hotter, the precipitation that does fall falls as rain rather than snow. So the problem is that in California, we have sort of two time-release sources of water, water that we can basically water banks. Those are the huge aquifer under the Central Valley, and which is a long-lived bank. And then a shorter sort of shorter-lived bank, which is the snowpack. And because when the climate heats, it's more likely that precipitation will fall as rain rather than snow. We're depleting that second bank. California is going to have to adapt to the loss of that bank. And this paces, it's a pacing issue for us. It's a real challenge to our water agencies. And how California deals with that issue is going to be one that's going to test our ability to come up with cooperative and societally and environmentally sustainable solutions.
But there are still some, of course, who argue that human activity is not responsible in any way for climate change. So I know your research addresses that directly, so I'd like you to explain to the audience about radiative forcing and other things that you've studied, and let's kind of put that to bed once and for all, and we'll get it on tape.
Sure. There are two ways that we know that mankind is causing climate change. The first is that we can compare what's happening now to the geologic record. And in the geologic record, the big actors were changes in the sun and changes due to volcanoes. Those both produce signatures in the temperature of the climate system that don't match what we're seeing now. The only way that we can explain the temperature signals that we're seeing now, and this is the fact that the lower atmosphere is warming and the upper atmosphere is cooling, the only way to explain that is from an increase in greenhouse gases. There's no other physics that can explain that. So then you ask, where's this greenhouse gas coming from? Well, we know the answer to that too, because carbon comes in different flavors. These are called isotopes. Mm-hmm. Plants like light isotopes, and you see a different mix of these isotopes from fossil fuels. The only way to explain the increase in carbon dioxide that we're seeing in the Earth's atmosphere right now is from fossil fuel combustion. It's not from volcanoes, it's only from fossil fuels. So point A, we know the only way to explain the temperature pattern is from greenhouse gases. Point B, we know the only way to explain the greenhouse gases is from fossil fuel combustion. Case closed.
Okay.
And those two points, by the way, there's essentially no serious contest to those two points in the literature. There's a lot of nibbling around the edges, but no serious debate.
I want to ask you, do you ever get discouraged?
Do you ever get discouraged? I am an optimist on this issue. We're lucky that we're living in a time when we can measure the problem, we can characterize the problem. We've seen major shifts in public opinion towards solutions. And fortunately, I think we can make a transition to a more sustainable energy supply. What does discourage me is the fact that the really smart people are really, really good at burying their heads in the sand. Mm-hmm. So that's the discouraging part.
Yeah.
So every alternate day, so on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'm discouraged. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and I'm an optimist.
You're feeling better? Okay. Great. Yeah. On that note, we're going to end our first segment. So we are now ready to take questions.
This question has come in from our online audience, and I'll paraphrase a little bit. Do you have any advice about how the human species can wake up to how they are detrimentally affecting the Earth and be willing to change its behavior?
It's a really good point, and I think it's an issue that we'll have to come back to. Yeah, so we're not going to solve this problem by just all adopting screw-in LED light bulbs or by stopping flying. We as a species are going to have to change our attitude about how we interact with the Earth, and take cohabitation with the web of life much more seriously. This is an issue that I'm starting to talk about with colleagues at Berkeley about how we affect change in attitude. But this is going to take a long time, and I have to say that scientists like myself are going to have to be part of that solution. But this is something that we're going to have to do in concert with people who think about advertising. Think about climate equity, think about the arts, think about all the ways that you can affect change in people's attitudes. It's going to be a system-wide issue.
Okay, thank you. Oh, we'll take one more, yes, so then. Quick one, please.
Okay, well, I'm hoping that you could talk not just about California, but particularly in terms of loss of glaciers. I'm worried very much about the Indus River and the other glacial sources of water throughout the world, which seem to be affecting a lot of population, much more even than California.
No, you're absolutely correct. There are on the order of 2 billion people who rely on water sources, which are drawn in large part from glacial melt. And that's a water bank that was put in place with the formation of the Himalayas, and that, so it's been in place for tens of millions of years. And that water bank is going to be seriously stressed by climate change. That is an almost unique challenge. And the way that's going to have to be addressed is a worldwide engagement with Pakistan, with India, and with China, and one in which we go to them with open arms, running open, an open extension of what we've discovered as best practices, and then draw from them what they've done to meet this. Really, it's truly a Himalayan-sized challenge, but that's an area where water, you're going to see how much more viable water is than oil once that becomes a stress point in that part of the world. Because you can't drink oil. I mean, you have to drink water, and people are going to really realize how acute water is as a resource once they go to draw from that tap and nothing comes out.
That was Professor Bill Collins, Director of the New Climate and Ecosystem Science Division at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. He's an internationally recognized expert in climate modeling and climate change science. Before joining UC Berkeley and Berkeley Lab, Dr. Collins was a senior scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. As lead author on the fourth assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, he was a co-recipient of the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. Come back for more excerpts from this almost two-hour-long interview. The event was also posted on YouTube, and you can find it at the Berkeley Lab channel under the title, Climate Change is Here, Now What? Thanks to the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab for their March 24, 2016 recording. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. For more information, call 707-463-2654 or go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.